Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Joe Morris, Ahmad Rahab, and Gidi Nashat. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And tonight, for the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about the comments of President Obama last week in Cairo, Egypt, the ramifications of that speech, which was it was well-hyped and it's been well-analyzed already. But again, the key analysis has not yet come from the American people, and this is your opportunity to offer that for the next couple of hours on our broadcast. 1-800-723-8289, and I'm very pleased to welcome some people that will have probably differing perspectives on what the president had to say last evening. And I want to begin by also identifying that every guest on our program tonight, at least in studio in Chicago, is an American citizen. Okay? Just put that out there. Ahmad Rahab joins us. Ahmad, nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to
be here. You are an Egyptian-American. You were born in Cairo. You are the executive director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and we'll talk more about that as the program unfolds this evening. But my question to you, as it will be to all of our guests this evening, will the speech of the president last week in Cairo, will it cause anyone, any of the major players in the Middle East, to act differently in the future?
I think it will. I think it was a successful speech in terms of showing the genuineness of the United States, represented by its president, Barack Obama. And I think the people took good note that there is a change in direction in terms of where the United States wants to go with the relationship, in its relationship with the Muslim-majority world.
Joe Morris also joins us. Normally, we introduce him as our conservative Republican. You were also the first president of B'nai B'rith in the Midwest. You're a law partner at Morris and De La Rosa, and also you're a former Reagan Justice Department official. Your answer to the same question?
I think it will have an effect. I hope it does. The effect, however, may not be among the governments of the Middle East. I think the president here was trying to speak over the heads of governments in some respects. There were a couple of messages in the speech addressed to important Middle Eastern governments. But the really remarkable and new and different thing about the speech was that the president was speaking over the heads of governments to Muslim people in general, Arab people in particular, and trying to send a message directly to them. In an effort to change hearts and minds about the United States, about relations among the three great Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and about how they relate to their own governments and their own civilizations.
Gidi Nashat also joins us. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, also teaches Islamic and Middle Eastern history at the University of Illinois at Chicago, just a few blocks from where we do this broadcast. Gidi was born in Baghdad, but has been an American citizen since 1978. Your answer to the same question. Anybody going to act differently based on the words out of Cairo last week?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think as both Ahmad and Joe have said, it sent a very different message, very positive, and what really made me happy was that it gave recognition to the interconnection of these different, very major, important faiths in the region. But we have to see what will happen next. Now, will Mrs. Clinton be able to implement some of the things that the president has mentioned in his speech? What would be the reaction of some of the governments? What will be our reaction to, let's say, what's going on in Lebanon with the Lebanese election and what's going to happen in Iran? But I think it's a wonderful first step. I was absolutely impressed by the way the president spoke, by his effort to reach to the people, as Joe said, over the heads of government. So I thought it was an excellent first step.
Now, talking about to the audience, you have the leaders of the Middle East, you have the Arab street, and then you have the American street. Speak to each of those audiences and how this speech might have played there, Ahmad. What about just the difference between the leaders? Let's talk about your native country of Egypt. Let's talk about, you know, the leaders and the people in the street don't necessarily see eye to eye there.
I agree with that, and I agree with Joe earlier that this speech was mostly directed at the people. I think it's evidenced by the fact that Mubarak, President Mubarak of Egypt, kept a pretty low-key profile during this visit. He met with President Obama for a few minutes, but was not there at the airport and was not there at the speech itself, perhaps through the design of the Obama administration. They wanted to make sure that this message was being clearly perceived as being sent to the people. So I think I don't have high expectations in terms of change from Arab or Muslim-majority country governments. More so, I expect the people to have a change in heart in terms of how they perceive the United States.
And what should be the, from the Arab perspective, what should be the next step? If this was an olive branch of the, at least a rhetorical olive branch from the President of the United States, what should be the proper response from leadership in the Arab world?
I think the key word is rhetorical. You're right. This was a speech. It was a speech of words. Discourse is important. Words are important. But what's equally important, if not more, is following up through policy and action. And that's precisely what the people and the governments are going to be waiting to see.
And Joe, what do you think that might be?
Well, I think it's right. Words are important. This is not the first president to have spoken to Islamic audiences. President Dwight Eisenhower, 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, spoke at the inauguration, the dedication of the Islamic Center in Washington, D.C., the mosque that President Bush, George W. Bush, spoke at the week of the events of September 11th. But I think something very interesting that the president did was he chose as his location Cairo University. In the heart of Cairo, actually on the west side of the river in Giza, not too far from the pyramids. There are three great universities in Cairo, and he mentioned two of the three. He mentioned Al-Azhar, which is about 1,000 years old and is one of the great global institutions of learning. It's up there in terms of civilizational history with in age with the universities of Bologna, Paris, Oxford, Cambridge, and is a place where Western civilization was kept alive and retransmitted to Europe. And the president made passing note of that. Cairo University is about 100 years old. That was the actual venue of the place and is, I think, generally recognized as a more or less secular institution in Egypt. The third university is now in the suburbs. It's American University at Cairo. The president didn't go there. He went to this post-medieval and then institution and invoked the name of the great thousand-year-old Al-Azhar Religious University. What's that all about? I think the significance there is that the president was saying, this isn't so much a political speech as it is an address from one part of Western civilization to another part of Western civilization, and trying to open a dialogue well beyond merely the political boundaries. Certainly the president had to address current political policy issues, either to establish his bona fides or because a couple of them, including the question of Iran's acquisition of nuclear weapons, is just so hot. But really, the president's agenda, it seemed to me, was very different. It was trying to awaken or reawaken the masses of Islamic civilization to their own civilization and to opportunities to get back in the action of Western civ.
Gideon Lashad, I know you have a response to that, but we do have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, talking tonight about President Obama's speech last week in Cairo, Egypt, speaking to the Muslim world. Your reaction, 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago. From Oakland, California to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. Gidi Nishad is here. You wanted to respond to something that Joe Morris had to say before the break?
Well, it wasn't a response to what he was saying. I was going to elaborate maybe a little bit more. Having been a teacher of Islamic civilization, I feel that one of the things about Middle Easterners and Muslims is that they are aware of how great their civilization has been. And I think one of the problems today for Muslims is that they've woken up and they found themselves that way behind the West. And this is one of the reasons why they feel frustrated, humiliated. And I thought President Obama did the right thing by trying to reach them, to reach out to them rather than say, you're with us or you're with us or against us.
What does it say, though? Because I think the question that many people listening and watching the program tonight want to know is, Is it going to make a Muslim anywhere in the world, is it going to make the words of last week, is it going to make any of them less likely to want to pick up a bomb, strap it to themselves, and become suicide bombers or fly planes into buildings? That's what they want to know, Ahmad. What's your answer to that?
Well, I think we have to be very careful about that kind of discourse, because the majority of Muslims around the world are never going to strap bombs to themselves and blow up buildings. And these are the majority of the people who are listening to Obama in the first place. Those who are likely to do that have no interest in listening to Obama or even to moderate Muslims who are the majority.
But is there something, and maybe we talk about the next step. What are some things that that moderate Arabs or moderate Muslims, those that everyone listening to this program would acknowledge, they're the good Muslims. Is there anything that they should be doing, saying, to try to further reduce the likelihood and the spread of the more militant factions? Because I don't think that's a message that the average American gets. If it's happening, I don't think we're getting that message.
I think you're right in the sense that we're not getting the message because we don't know where to listen and we don't know who to talk to. But it is very important for me to say, as someone who travels back to the Muslim majority world often, that the great majority of people are not involved in this kind of thing, in extremism or radicalism or violence, and are very much against it, heart and mind. What's equally important to understand is that this dialogue of civilizations that Joe correctly referred to is one between the sort of rational West and the rational Muslim majority world, not the irrational. And I think the problem was with President Bush is that he was addressing the extreme and irrational fringe of the Muslim majority world in talking to Muslims.
Now, let me ask this question, Joe, because the other part of this important equation is the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Palestinian conflict specifically. And that question is, it has been described that by some analysts of the speech that really what the president did somewhat is he sort of gave a green light to Iran that they could continue to grow their nukes. That there wasn't any real strong rhetoric here. So much was focused on the Israelis and the Palestinians and getting their act together that perhaps maybe he took his eye off what many believe to be the most significant issue in the region, and that is the spread of nuclear weapons within Iran.
Well, I think there were flaws in the president's approach, and that's you're signaling one of them. I think the president made the mistake of adding fuel to the proposition that the central issue in Middle Eastern relations and between the United States and the Muslim world are relations between Palestinian Arabs and Palestinian Jews, that is to say Israelis. I also think, however, there's a flaw in your question, with all due respect, Bruce, that the danger that Iranian acquisition, at least acquisition by the current Iranian regime of weapons of mass destruction of any kind, including nuclear weapons, is not just to Israel. It is an existential threat to lots of peoples, lots of governments, regimes of different complexions around the Middle East. And the president pushed it down. It was third or fourth on the list of issues that he spoke to in Iran and in Cairo. And I assure you that as the president was delivering his speech, it was being parsed very carefully in chanceries and caves, you know, throughout the region, people trying to figure out what does this mean politically. And there were big questions. There was doubt about what was he saying about Iran. What was the message that he was trying to convey to Iran? There seemed to be lots of carrots. There were questions about whether or not there were sticks. Something happened today, this very day, on George Stephanopoulos' broadcast on ABC. He interviewed Secretary Clinton. And he put to Secretary Clinton the question. Actually, she raised the topic. If there were an Iranian nuclear attack on Israel, she said there would be massive retaliation. George Stephanopoulos asked the question, by the United States? And Secretary Clinton said, there would be massive retaliation. And then a salient pause. She conspicuously avoided that
question. She didn't give him the headline.
Right. Well, or she may, maybe...
She didn't give him the big headline.
Maybe she gave him a headline of a different court, of a different kind. There is doubt as to whether or not there would be retaliation by the United States. I don't think anyone has any doubt that there would be massive retaliation by Israel.
Now, may I interrupt here? Because
sure. Anytime
for me,
you want.
For me, okay. For me right now, the major problem in terms of nuclear threat in the Middle East or the Muslim world is really what's happening in Pakistan. Half the country is going radical Islamic. Here is a country where the military also has great sympathy to some of these Islamics, and they have the bomb. And here we're worrying about a potential threat from Iran. What about what's going on in Pakistan, one of the bigger Islamic countries, which is on the brink of collapse? And in a way, I cannot believe our neglect of what's going on in this major country with its huge problems. And we keep worrying about what will happen if Iran develops a bomb in 2, 3, 5, 10 years. And this is a thing that really is worrying to me.
I don't think you disagree with that.
I don't disagree with that at all.
I think I can tell you why.
I mean, the regimes in Pakistan, for all their defects and so forth, have not been threatening use of weapons. One must allow that the regime in Tehran is capable of saying goofy things, I mean, and very frightening things, which is why its fresh acquisition of weapons is front and center for the president. But
Joe,
Pakistan, you're absolutely right. It is a very serious problem.
But when we talk about things like nuclear proliferation, we can't have double standards. I think we have to have a principle and we have to have standards, whether or not there's somebody who is talking, you know, in a way that scares us or not, because it's all subjective. So I think that it's equally important to focus on Pakistan and Iran as well as Israel. And that's one thing that's missing in the conversation. I think a lot of people in the Middle East, in the Arab world and Muslim-majority world in general, feel that the discourse on nuclear proliferation from the United States is disingenuous, because we all know that the state of, you know, Israel possesses weapons of nuclear material. And so there's not much conversation going about that. And
you must allow that Israel has no interest in threatening any of its neighbors. There's no Israeli interest in territorial acquisition or denying somebody else an existence. But you must also allow that President Ahmadinejad has clearly, overtly, expressly threatened the existence of the State of Israel and its people.
But Israel, not Iran, was involved in three wars in the Middle East during your lifetime. And so we cannot disavow the possibility that at some point it could say that in order to protect ourselves and our existence, we need to move forward with some kind of military action.
May I just intervene, say something? You told me I can say.
You can.
Now, Avigdor Lieberman is somebody who's just as extreme right as Ahmadinejad, and he has made statements about it.
And who is this for the audience?
He's the foreign minister of Israel.
Okay.
He's an extreme right-wing person who has said we should have thrown bombs on the leaders of Hamas. I mean, when he opens his mouth, there is no end to it. Let's get rid of the Arabs. This is all land of Israel. God gave it to us. Well, he's certainly a lot for me. He's a much more or as dangerous as Ahmadinejad is. But on the other hand, if you watch what's going on in Iran, you will see that Iranians, one of the reasons they want to get rid of Ahmadinejad is because of some of these irresponsible statements he has made. And some of the candidates, including Mr. Mousavi, has said he has threatened our country by attacking Israel, by criticizing Israel, by denying the Holocaust. So Ahmadinejad doesn't have the kind of power that his statements may reflect. And even if Iran did have a bomb, it doesn't mean they're going to. Who's going to throw the bomb on Israel?
Are there other than Israel, which obviously in the United States, which has articulated their concern about Iran having nuclear weapons?
Right.
Where are the other strong voices in the Middle East who share that belief?
Egypt. Egypt has been historically opposed to any sort of nuclear acquisition in the Middle East, especially from Iran. And so the Egyptian government, I have to say, while I disagree with a lot of policies they have, has been very strong in speaking out against the potential of Ahmadinejad, or Iran, I should say, possessing weapons of nuclear destruction.
And should we, in reality, knowing that even domestic politicians sometimes say things because for domestic purposes, that sometimes the rhetoric gets a little far afield.
And
would you say, you were talking about an Israeli leader, we're talking about Ahmadinejad.
Right.
I mean, is part of this just domestic politics that Joe, he really doesn't mean it. He just says it because it plays well in the papers.
Gidi's right that
Khrushchev was going to bury us too. He didn't.
Avigdor Lieberman's rhetoric is not smooth, and the Netanyahu government may have a problem. If as foreign minister he continues the kind of rhetoric that typified him as a campaign leader of his party, Yisrael Beiteinu. But I have to say there is no real equivalence between Lieberman, whose statements come in the context of domestic politics, and President Ahmadinejad of Iran, who has gone around the world repeating over and over again this rhetoric of destroying Israel, wiping Jewish people off the face of the earth, denying the existence of the Holocaust, and provoking, frankly, I mean, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes of President Obama's speech at Cairo was directed at refuting Ahmadinejad and making the moral case against Ahmadinejad's refusal to recognize the reality, the historical reality of the Holocaust.
Well, but
the president himself then coupled a trip to Buchenwald immediately following the trip to Cairo to reinforce that rejection of the Ahmadinejad view of the
world.
We've
got to pause. Everybody wants to talk. We've got a full board of lights. We're going to bring them into the conversation as well. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border on America's great radio stations and XM and satellite radio. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Grand Rapids, Michigan to Bakersfield, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our guests this evening include Joe Morris. Joe Morris is an attorney in private practice. He also served President Reagan as the Assistant Attorney General of the United States and Director of the Department of Justice Office of Liaison Services. He's also an American delegate, or was an American delegate, to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School and undergraduate. Always nice to have you with us, Joe.
Thank you, Bruce.
Ahmad Rahad also joins us this evening. He is the Executive Director of the Chicago Office on the Council of American Islamic Relations. It's the nation's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy group. He was born in Cairo, Egypt. He's been a United States citizen since 1997, a University of Illinois graduate. In fact, his professor was Gidi Nishat, who also joins us this evening. And she, in addition to being a teacher of Islamic and Middle Eastern history at the University of Illinois at Chicago, she's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and also is a member of the Iranian Studies Association. 1-800-723-8029. Let's go to Detroit, where Doug is listening to us on WoWo out of Fort Wayne. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I just wanted to note a certain danger maybe with the general tenor and tactics that Obama used in his speech writing, where he more or less talked about the complexities of the issues and kind of played both sides. And I think he gave a lot of hope to both sides, which is important. But I think in reality, sooner or later, or at least in a lot of the cases, we're going to be forced to actually take a position. And I think that when you're raising everybody's hopes, you're bound to let down somebody. And as far as building relationships, you know, you don't build those with words. You build them with action and following through on what you say.
Stay on the line. I think you've brought up a very interesting point. I'd like to discuss it, and I'll even give you a follow-up. But, Ahmad, I want you to respond to the first part of the suggestion that in raising hopes, you're likely to maybe to disappoint people down the road.
President Obama mitigated that by talking about great compromises that both sides had to give on any of the conflicts that he talked about. And I think he's right. I think that, as he said, everybody has to get serious. And to get serious, you have to make compromises. If you stick to your guns and you don't want to budge an inch, we're not going to move forward, whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or whether it is the rift between the West and the Muslim-majority world in terms of perceptions, or rather misperceptions.
Joe?
The president made a distinction between the war in Afghanistan, he called it a war of necessity, and the war in Iraq, he called it a war of choice. He came very close, not quite, but came close to apologizing for the war in Iraq. And I think, unfortunately, gave short shrift to what the United States and its allies have accomplished in Iraq for the benefit of the people of Iraq. He also, I think, omitted to recount for his audience other expenses of American blood and treasure for the benefit of Muslim peoples around the world, from Bosnia and Kosovo to, you know, Somalia and on into the Middle East and elsewhere. I think that it's unfortunate that President Bush's line, if you're not with us, you're against us, was wildly and widely misinterpreted as a threat to Muslims in general, as opposed to, I think, a much more narrow sense of what he was looking for in terms of cooperation, this global outrage at this extremist act that had taken place in the United States. President Obama did, however, try to get very specific when he turned to talking about Afghanistan, about what the United States would do and what needed to happen in Afghanistan. And if I may quote just a sentence that the president said in Cairo, military power alone is not going to solve the problems in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Gidi, he did mention Pakistan. Then he went on to say, that's why we plan to invest $1.5 billion each year over the next 5 years to partner with Pakistanis to build schools and hospitals, roads and businesses, hundreds of millions to help with those who have been displaced. That's why we're providing more than $2.8 billion to help Afghans develop their economy and deliver services that people depend on. Full stop. Well, well and good. I mean, here he is making the point that the United States is trying to be generous and do its part. But what was utterly missing from that section of the speech is the crucial central role of the people of Afghanistan themselves, or the people of Iraq themselves, in taking responsibility for the nature of their culture, their political society, the way they treat women, the way they build their economy, the way they relate to other peoples in other countries. And it's simply not enough to say that this is sort of one more U.S. spending program. If that's the action coming out of the United States that's intended here, that's missing the great civilizational dialogue opportunity that the president opened here.
Gidi.
Well, I agree that, I mean, from my perspective, the style of the president was wonderful, but we have to wait and see how the substance will be implemented, because we're dealing with really some very difficult issues in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. These are the three major areas.
Was the style and the tone very similar, however, to what we heard? The way he spoke on the campaign? Because it seems to me that also what was clear here, and obviously he did it at a university, he's talking to a younger generation. He's trying to sort of like organize the world for the next primary.
Right.
That's my view of the way he's
acting. Well, maybe, but one of the things we should also take into account is that many of these younger people in the Middle East, they don't really have control over what their governments do. And our relationship so far has been with these dictatorial, authoritarian governments who would be opposed to ideas, let's say democracy. They'd be very much opposed to it, as we was mentioned here. Therefore, it may raise expectations, as the caller said, but in a way, we may have more problems, because then some of these expectations will not be carried out.
Doug, are you buying what you're hearing?
Yeah, I think I agree totally with what she had said.
Okay, good. I'm glad we've got a satisfied customer. Ahmad, final word to you, and then we're going to move on.
Well, just to be as clear as possible, we cannot divorce this speech from the context of the past 8 years before President Obama and the poor image that the United States suffered in the Muslim-majority world as a result of not just the discourse of President Bush, where he said, you're either with us or against us, but the policies and actions from torture to Abu Ghraib to the mismanagement of Iraq in general to Guantanamo. All these things cannot be discounted. And so Obama knew that he had his work cut out for him to climb out of that hole that we have been dug into and to reclaim the image of the United States as a leader of the world that can be trusted. It's powerful. Everybody knows that. But the question is, can it be trusted? Can it be deemed as genuine?
Let's go to Sylvia, listening to us in Winnebago, Illinois, on WLS, our flagship station. Go ahead, Sylvia.
Yeah, what did that hieroglyphic mean that Obama spotted on the wall there in that tomb? Amongst all the other hundreds of hieroglyphics, he saw one right off the bat that looked like him.
Ahmad.
It was just an image of a commoner, or, you know, not a pharaoh, and he had rather large ears. So it was just to the comic side of President Obama that he said, I think I look like that guy.
Ron in Knoxville, Tennessee, listening to us on WNOX. You're on the air next.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
My statement is very simple, sir, and if I was angry with the gentleman who answered the phone, I apologize. First of all, this man does not tell the truth. The fact is there's 1.5 or 2 billion Muslims around the world, and they're controlled and misused and beat up by a small majority of their own people. How come they don't take control of the situation that they're living in? Number two, my point is that Barack Obama stood on that stage in Cairo and said that this would be one of the largest Muslim nations in the world. That cannot be true, sir. If we only have 2.3 or whatever the number is of Muslims in this country, versus what they have in the rest of the Muslim world.
Well, I think, let me just interject for a moment. I want to get, I'll get everybody a chance to respond. But again, I heard some of the analysts sort of, they were a little taken back by the population that estimate for number of Muslims in the United States. So let me ask you, let me ask our one of our two Muslims on the panel this evening, head of the Chicago Office of Council of Islamic American Islamic Relations, how many Muslims are there in the United States?
There is no official census of faith-based communities in the United States. And so the number that has been used traditionally, owing to certain surveys and studies, has been 7 to 8 million or 6 to 8 million. Recently, the Pew Research studies, I think, arrived at a number 2.5 million. So any of those numbers can be quoted since we don't have an official number that we can use as an objective number.
The most reliable statistical reports that I have seen, including, if for what it's worth, the CIA factbook on the United States, has the Muslim population of the United States at 1.8 million. The number 7 million seems wildly inflated, although that is the number that the president chose to use. And it's unclear where that population is to be found. The president did quote two other statistics, however, which are absolutely true. There is at least one mosque in every one of the 50 states, and, you know, insert 57 state joke here. Remember the president's flub during the campaign when he miscounted the American states. But there is at least one mosque in every one of the 50 states, plus the District of Columbia. And it's way easier to count institutions, and there are at least 1,200 incorporated or established Muslim mosques of various sort of denominations. You know, some are very large, like the one in Washington or the one in New York.
And one in Chicago, too.
The ones in the Chicago suburbs.
Right.
And some are small storefront mosques, but there are about 1,200 in there.
Before we take another call, I want to ask you a question, Gideon, and that is because I didn't get your answer to the question I asked at the beginning of the broadcast. What olive branch, if this speech last week was an olive branch from the President of the United States to the Muslim world, what sort of olive branch should we get back? What should we look for? Who in the Arab or the Muslim world, who should step up and do something, and what should they do? Just because then we can do more. I mean, it's back and forth.
Well, okay, we've offered an olive branch, but what does the olive branch mean? Now, Lebanon is having an election today. We don't know the results, but one of the major players in the Lebanese election is Hezbollah. Now, are we going to recognize them? That would be a real olive branch. Financial Times, which is very
important. That would be an olive branch by us, though.
By us, right. And then
what I want to ask is what should their olive branch be about? We do have to pause.
Okay.
Think about that.
All right.
What olive branch should we be looking for from the Muslim world? Back shortly from Chicago. From El Paso, Texas to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's go to El Paso, Texas right now, where Steve is listening to us on KTSM. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
I wanted to address the problem where women in the Islamic world are typically treated in various degrees of atrociousness. It ranges from really bad stuff in parts of Africa, female circumcision and the resultant genital mutilation, to relatively innocuous things like different standards for dress and other things like that. And I never hear anyone in the Muslim world offer a good defense for this. Their justifications range from, well, our religion asks that of women and to do it willingly, or your religion is also bad. And I reject all those arguments as fallacious. It's never valid to say, well, it's okay because you guys do bad things too. Two wrongs don't make a right. And to claim that it's okay because our God wants us to is also fallacious, and I'd like to see this addressed.
Let's let Gidi respond to that. We should also mention that you are an advisor on gender issues
right,
to the
World Bank. Right.
And you've studied and written on this particular topic.
Absolutely.
So put it in context.
Number one, we have to remember that the Islamic world is not a monolithic kind of society. There are 1.5 billion Muslims, and in many of these countries, the treatment of women has been influenced by the cultural and social norms that were in place before Islam came. This is true of the origin of, let's say, the original home of Islam in Arabia, to the rest of the Middle East, to Indonesia, to Africa. So you really have to make a distinction about where you're talking about. Now, I'm a Muslim woman.
What about the Quran, though?
The Quran, in fact, is, if you look at it in terms of a religious text and you compare it to either the Old Testament or the New Testament, you will see that in most ways. And of course, Joe has also studied this issue. And the role of women in the Quran is much more progressive by our standards of today than the other two major religions of Abrahamic religions.
Progressive in what way?
Progressive, let's say, women in Islam, they inherit. When they get married, they're consent is important. They become independent. When they're married, they have control of whatever wealth they have and assets. The husband, nobody else can enter or touch their assets. They can do whatever they want. They can engage in anything they want to do. They can be educated. They could be educated. Historically, and this went on in the medieval times, many Muslim women became important theologians in their own rights, and they taught men. It's true, seclusion was one of the highlights or one of the important marks.
So when did the exclusions and the repression of women that is more popularly known now, when did that begin?
Well, we have to, again, remember where we're talking about, because to begin with, as the caller said, many of these women would like to feel they're protected or they are dressed appropriately. Again, in the West, let's say, women can wear a bikini when they go to the beach. But do you see women, let's say, if they're going to work, would they be dressing bikini? No, because there are standards and conventions on how people dress. And the same thing applies to women in the Middle East. This is a part of the culture. It's a part of the practice. I don't do it. When I go to one of these countries, I may wear a scarf. But this was also true of all societies in the past. Women in the past, whether it was classical Greece, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, they all were secluded and covered their hair. If you look at pictures of Madonnas in, let's say, medieval paintings, you will always see the Madonna's hair is covered with something, because this was a very widespread practice throughout the world.
Ahmad.
I agree with everything Gidi just said, and I'll add that some of the problems that we face in terms of the stereotyping of Muslims or the misperceptions regarding Muslims is the tendency to generalize, the tendency to view all Muslims and Islam as a whole as a single monolith that acts and behaves the same way. And more often than not, it's appropriated to the worst specimen of behavior in the Muslim majority world rather than to the best. And so I will tell our caller, for example, to consider the lifestyle of the average Muslim woman in Istanbul or Cairo versus that in the mountains of Afghanistan or in one of the villages in the desert region of Saudi Arabia. And you'll find that they're wholly different in the way they look, in the way they behave, in the way they think. And so Islam or Muslims in general are not a monolith. I will add that there are Muslims who have rendered a perverse interpretation to the Islamic texts. And so, yes, it is mostly cultural that Muslim women are their rights are abused. But also, I will admit that there are Muslim men in the Muslim majority world who have unfortunately submitted to a perverse interpretation of Islam.
If you draw a line in history, say the year 900, and compare the life of women in Islamic communities as they were then with those that were Christian or Jewish communities, by and large, a woman would be better off in an Islamic community in the year 900 in most places, not everywhere, but in most places in the world. That isn't the case today, and the question is what happened? And the answer adverts to something I think that Gidi mentioned before, that in a few centuries ago, something happened, and the West continued to make social and cultural and civilizational progress, and the Islamic world, for some reason, ground to a halt. And now, with the world getting smaller because of communication and so on, we're coming face to face with that. It produces shame and horror and reaction and so forth in Islamic communities. The question, and it's a question that all of us in good faith have been wrestling with, and lots of Muslim leaders and many, and now this president of the United States also wrestling with, you know, how can that change? How can that be brought about to change? A bellwether, a crucial question for kind of measuring the progress of a civilization is how it treats its women. Absolutely crucial. And any community that rules out of the possibilities of education and rules out of the possibilities of involvement in the sciences and in the arts and in communication and expression is really doing injury to itself, because in every culture it is women who are bringing up children.
And that's a discussion happening.
What you can do is you can say to the next hour, for those watching us on television, we're going to see you next week. For those listening to us on radio, 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. All of our guests will be back for a next full hour. And if you're watching this on television, the rest of this conversation will be next week's broadcast. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Joe Morris, Ahmad Rahab, and Gidi Nashat. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. And we now continue our discussion that we began recently about the president's trip to Cairo, Egypt, and his address to the Muslim world. We're talking about the reaction, not only domestic U.S. political reaction, but primarily the reaction of the Islamic world to the speech, and whether or not it's going to make us feel any safer. And I would like to get Ahmad Rahab's response to that. He is the executive director of the Chicago office on the Council of American Islamic Relations. And the one thing that everybody who is listening and watching this broadcast this evening, Ahmad, hopes is that we're going to be safe. And they hope that out of the speech and the rhetoric in Cairo, the cooler heads are going to prevail. And there's going to be the less likelihood of an attack on the United States in any terrorist way. So a question I would ask you and ask everyone on the panel to begin this hour is, how will we know if the speech last week was a success? How are we going to measure the success of that speech and whether or not hearts and minds are really changing in the Middle East?
Well, I think if you watch Egyptian and other Arab satellite programs, as I do, to try to gauge the reaction from public officials, from thinkers and writers and other types of individuals in the Middle East and the Muslim world, you will find that they have taken well to the message of President Obama's outreach to the Muslim majority world, and that they feel that he's genuine. And that's what's been missing from President Bush's discourse and policies, even when he perhaps had good intentions. He did say good things about Islam. People did not feel that he was genuine, and his policies and actions definitely did not do well for his discourse.
Joe Morris, is he a little? Do you agree with that he's a little more believable than George Bush?
Well, inevitably, and I'm not sure, necessarily sure that that's President Bush's fault, but President Bush
is it because of his Muslim background?
Well, in part it's because of his Muslim background, and by the way, I think it's a great thing. During the campaign, we all had to be apparently we had to be careful. We were upbraided if you made much reference of his Muslim background or made use of his middle name. I think it's a healthy thing. That now we can openly say that President Obama's middle name is Hussein, and that he has these Muslim antecedents and connections and Muslim schooling in Indonesia and so forth. It's right and proper now to get that out on the table, and it's a shame that it wasn't during the campaign a year ago. If they did,
he might not be president of the United States.
Well, now he is.
They were going the other way.
Absolutely, I agree.
I don't know if I have uncles.
Yeah.
Now he is president of the United States. You know, for good or for ill. And he has these credentials that create openings, create opportunities for conversation with people in the Muslim world. We have to have these conversations with people in the Muslim world. It is a conversation that is long overdue. It is a conversation that's made difficult because we're comparing apples and oranges. The president is talking about America and Islam. You know, the one is a nation with a government. The other is a religion with a whole host of attached cultural and civilizational attributes, and is spread over many, many nation states with many, many different kinds of governments.
Gidi, I want to get your response. Gidi Nishat from the University of Illinois also joins us. She was born in Baghdad. And I want to ask you to respond basically to the same question. How should we measure whether or not those words are making things better? And I want to put it in the context of something that I've said almost repeatedly on this show since 9/11, and that is, as we've measured the fact that there has not been a second terrorist attack against the United States homeland since September 11th, that the policies of the Bush administration, the interrogation, the crackdowns, whatever you want to call it,
right,
waterboarding, whatever,
right, right,
some of that was working because we haven't been attacked.
Yes.
So I guess my question to you would be, if that's the way, that's sort of the way my mind has worked, if we have not had another domestic terrorist attack in the United States or terrorist attack directed at the United States for the next 4 years, does Barack Obama and does the rhetoric of Cairo get some credit for perhaps soothing tensions, and maybe that's another contributing factor to peace in the homeland?
Well, I think you're really, again, putting the question the wrong way, because you're assuming that the 1.5 billion Muslims, they were all trying to hurt America, create another
9/11. Doesn't take a lot. Only took 19.
No, of course. And these people came from a very small and radical group of activists within a very tiny society like Saudi Arabia, who were radicals, they even tried to hurt Saudi Arabia. Most Muslims do not want to do that. We know that. So therefore, to say that now, because President Obama has spoken, we're not going to have another attack, it's not true, because even before, the day before the president spoke, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the assistant of Osama bin Laden, came out and said, we don't want Obama to come to our country. We don't believe in him. Therefore, those kinds of radical, hostile elements within the Muslim world, they're not going to change their view. But it's the majority who are very upset and who are grieved by the attitude of President Bush, who had this haughty imperial. I like President Bush, so don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that he was, in principle, mm-hmm. he hated Muslims. He didn't. And as both colleagues have said here, he did a lot to try to include Muslims in the U.S. government, to recognize some of the Muslim fees. So it really doesn't have to do with that.
All been clear that tonight. Okay. You all seem to agree that there are radical elements within Islam that have given it a bad name.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Now I want to talk about some other radicals are out there. There are firebrands within Israel that maybe don't really want peace either. You know, they don't really want it. Or they want it at a level that isn't going to be politically acceptable. Will they be affected by this? How will they be affected by this? And some of the things that the president suggested Israel maybe should do on the issue of the further expansion of settlements, is that a politically acceptable line that would succeed in Israel?
Well, the Israeli extremists are a pretty small part of Israel's population, and they exert very little in the way of significant political influence. I mean, one it would be absurd to deny that they exist, because they do, and every once in a while somebody erupts and commits an act of terrorist violence. Some Israeli Jew commits an act of terrorist violence, but this is...
Didn't one get to be the prime minister? I mean, what was it? Wasn't Sharon... Ariel Sharon sort of a father of that?
No,
Prime Minister
Sharon came up from through the Israeli army. You're confusing him with Menachem Begin,
okay. Right.
who was part of the armed resistance to the British
Stern Gang, was it Stern Gang or Irgun, one of the two.
The
yes.
Irgun in the interval between World War II and Israeli independence.
I'm going to let you finish this history lesson. It's important, but again,
you asked.
I know I asked, but commercials are on its way. I shouldn't have asked the question. But I asked it. You got 3 minutes to think of the answer. Not that you need 3 minutes to think of the answer. I'm Bruce Dumont. We'll be back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about President Barack Obama's speech to the Arab world and whether or not, or the Muslim world, and whether or not relations between Muslims and the United States can be improved. And Joe, you were finishing up because I had asked you before the break, about the firebrands in Israel and whether or not those forces of who seek who do not want peace. What political power do they have in Israel, and are they going to be continue to be a fly in the ointment in the search for peace?
I think it's fair to say that they're almost negligible in the Israeli body politic in terms of where Israel is going, and the crucial fact of Israeli political life is this: every serious player in Israeli politics is an advocate of the so-called two-state solution, and there's a very simple reason why. Israel cannot successfully continue to exist as a state that is both Jewish and democratic unless there are two states. This is the great Israeli dream, to have a state that is Jewish and to have a state that is a Western democracy. With the 1967 war and the change in boundaries and the acquisition of populations in the territories that were lost by Jordan, I mean, remember, there's never been an independent Palestinian Arab state. The West Bank territory had been annexed by the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. The Gaza territory had been administered by Egypt, neither particularly generously or democratically. And the Israelis inherited those Arab populations, both Christian and Muslim, and all the problems that came with it. The idea of incorporating those territories and those populations into Israel, although at one point contemplated, simply don't fly, because those are populations that will never be Jewish and will never go away. These are their homes. They have nowhere else to go. This is where they belong. So unless there is a two-state solution, there will eventually be a population of this land that is majority non-Jewish and may not be democratic. So if Israel wants to be convincingly, dominatingly majority Jewish and democratic, it has to be separated from the Muslim population, the Arab population.
I want to get Ahmad Rahab's
May I add one thing before you do?
Ten more seconds. We've got to move along.
The Israelis have long been committed to the two-state solution. The problem is whether or not the Palestinians have been committed to the two-state solution. It was rejected by Arabs in 1948. It was rejected at Camp David by Yasser Arafat.
The reality on the ground before us today suggests otherwise. It is Israel that is in occupation of Palestinian territories and not vice versa. And that's an often ignored fact by those who support the State of Israel. To answer your earlier question to Joe, I'm not so concerned about the firebrands in the State of Israel who are the Jewish terrorists or Jewish extremists that are as negligible probably as Joe describes them. I'm more concerned about the extremist positions within the mainstream Israeli government itself, which in my mind, owing to its position that they will not freeze settlements, let alone stop building on these settlements, is a very extreme position. And let's not forget, Israel is the state that is in the highest defiance of, or in defiance of the highest number of UN resolutions in the world today. And that also is something that is often ignored. And so the State of Israel needs to be moderate in its position, needs to move forward in action, not words, to bring about a peace and a two-state solution. That's not happening with an occupation, with building settlements on Palestinian territories.
Well, I would like to say something to continue what Joe was saying. It's true that the extremists in Israel are very small. But Israel being a democracy, and because of the party system they have, whoever wins the election will have to rely on some of these smaller parties. And unfortunately, during the last several elections, and particularly in this one, one of the most extreme groups, the Israel Beitenu, is that the name of...
Yeah. Israel, our home, is how it would translate.
Which is like Arabic, by the way. Avigdor Lieberman's party has become now a part of this coalition government. And their position is that they do not want the settlement. And some of the members of this group believe that this expansion of the settlements is a natural living space. They need living space. And unless this is really dealt with by Israelis first, I don't see any way that this problem is going to go away. It will only get worse. And perhaps President Obama's let's say, speech to the Muslims may have now increased some of the apprehension of Israelis. I've been following this, some of the recent papers. Some Israelis may even move more to the right because they're fearful that the unbreakable bond between the U.S. and Israel will weaken and they become more radicalized than before.
Something that President Bush used to talk about over and over again was the spread of democracy. Is there a thirst for democracy in the Middle East, Ahmad?
There's been a long-standing thirst for democracy in the Middle East, but you can't export an American brand of democracy and expect to succeed. What you can do is stop supporting the dictatorships in the region, which is something that we do, not just in the Middle East, but also in Latin America.
And how should we back away from that? In your view, how do we do it? Do we just cut off all money from one side and give it to another side? Do we ease out of it? I mean, give us a practical way to do it. And let's take a look at Egypt. Let's take a look at your country of birth.
Well, I think Obama's on the right track. I think we need to begin with cultural exchange programs. We have to begin by providing a model that they can see and want to emulate. And I think that's what's happening today. Just hearing President Obama talk very openly and transparently about both the errors that the United States has committed and the great things that we have created for the world, I thought caused people to think, why can't we be that transparent in our political discourse?
I want to go to Ron in St. Joe, Michigan, who wants to follow up on that. Ron, go ahead.
Hello, Bruce. Bruce, there is democracy in the Middle East, but if we don't like it, we destroy it. The guy who was in there before the Shah of Iran was a democratically elected government. The CIA did not like it. We destroyed it and put the Shah in. You said terrorists become president. George Bush first. He was a CIA agent, CIA chief. His terrorist activities and the CIA's activities in Vietnam, in Guatemala, in Chile, those are all terrorist activities, would you not say? And he became president. So you're quite right, Bruce.
All right, let's go to Gidi. I don't know if I agree with your assessment of my assessment, but go ahead, Gidi.
Okay. What I wanted to say is a follow-up on what Ahmad was saying. And the point is, and what you mentioned about should we stop giving them money, I think giving money is wrong. Whenever we give money, it leads to corruption because we give it to a government. And this enhances the ability of the government to become more authoritarian if they have those tendencies. It goes to the military and they turn around and try to suppress the people.
Where should
The money, we shouldn't give money. We should encourage these countries to try to develop their economies and try to have the governments not control the economy. That's basically the problem of the Middle East. They all have money. Iran has money. Iraq had money. Saudi Arabia has money.
But a concern of many Americans, at least those that call talk shows,
yes,
is they heard the story 5 or 6 years ago about the madrasas. They've read them in all the newspapers. Everybody can quote you chapter and verse about the hatred that is being taught in the madrasas. Where does the funding from the madrasas come from, and how do you stop that? Or is it realistic to believe that that's ever going to be stopped?
Now, actually, these madrasas are being stopped not because we're giving money to Pakistan, but because some of the Saudi leaders have realized that these madrasas are turning against them because some of these radicals from Saudi Arabia began to even try to disrupt the Saudi government. But
does everybody agree with that, with Gidi's assessment of that?
Somewhat. I think that, first of all, the term madrasa, it means school. And there are many moderate madrasas, many progressive madrasas. In fact, a lot of the sciences and arts that were preserved in the Middle East, in the Muslim-majority world, for the West and later brought to the West through the Renaissance, were preserved through madrasas. So let's not use the term to mean the violent or the extremist type of schools.
We're talking about the extremist madrasas.
Right.
Let's use qualifiers. They're not called madrasa anymore. But I mean, we can't engage in lazy intellectual discourse here. Just because we may mean something, but audiences may not understand what we mean. We have to be very specific.
The one thing that's loud and clear this evening is you're all agreeing that we're talking about a small percentage of Muslims who are extreme, and whether their extremism and radicalism came out of madrasas, you're right, is a school.
Except we always talk about them within the context of Islam and Muslims, and that's where the confusion arises. We're never talking about Al-Qaeda, and that's the scope of the discourse. We're not talking about violent extremists. We talk about Muslims and Islam,
and then we delve directly into the marginal extremists, as if we're talking about everybody else.
Gidi and then Joe.
Okay. The thing is that it is true that in Afghanistan, and in Pakistan, because these were two poor countries, and some wealthy Saudi Arabians who were religious began to give money to these countries to create these religious schools that taught Wahhabi type of Islam, which is very radical, very puritanical. They consider only their own version of Islam as the true belief, and they're opposed to all other Muslims, and they consider them heretics. And it was because these two countries were poor that we ended up getting these huge number of madrasas. And they are called madrasa because even though modern schools in the Middle East or any Muslim world are not called madrasa,
yes, they are.
You're right.
I went to a school that was called a madrasa, and well, it was a school that had nothing to do with the
maybe,
sort of thing
maybe,
we're talking
but,
about.
But generally today, when they talk about madrasa, they mean these religious
when
schools
that
were
madrasa,
established.
That's what we mean, not when they talk
well,
about
madrasa.
Well,
not in Egypt. Not I've been in Egypt. I've lived in Egypt.
So let me just make sure
anyway,
that I'm hearing.
I just want
to clarify Ahmad's point. You're saying that in the Muslim world, madrasas has got a positive or at least a positive and negative response.
Right.
In the West, it's only viewed negatively.
Because here's what we do in our discourse on Islam and Muslims. We sort of hijack terms that mean multiple things in the Muslim majority world and then, you know, appropriate to them exclusive meanings.
Well, I think Gidi's,
and ignore the rest of the scope of it.
Gidi's point was that the hijacking is not done by Americans or Western observers. The hijacking is done by Islamic extremists. Who attach this label a definition to madrasas, who attach this label to Islam.
They will issue
fatwas.
You seem to agree with these people. I disagree with them.
Well,
so
instead of
agreeing with them, perhaps you should challenge
course,
them.
Well, and I think that's what we're all trying to do. I think that's
not in using the same terminology, the same definitions
that
they have put forth.
That's what they call these schools. I mean, you can't get away with it.
Gidi, Bin Laden says that Islam ought to kill all infidels. Do you agree with Bin Laden?
Of course I don't.
Exactly. Well, then why would you agree with the term madrasa? I mean, you don't agree with Bin Laden.
Because that's what they call them.
We're going to be back. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Okay.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let me reintroduce our guest. Joe Morris is here. He is an attorney in private practice. He served under President Reagan as an Assistant Attorney General of the United States and Director of the Department of Justice Office of Liaison Services. He was the first president in the Midwest of the B'nai B'rith back in the mid-1990s. And also joining us this evening is Ahmad Rahab. He is the Executive Director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations, a graduate of the University of Illinois at Chicago and DePaul University. He is also a member of the Egypt American Society and been a United States citizen since 1997. Gidi Nashat also joins us. She is a member of a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies, history rather, at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and a member of the Iranian Studies Association. She was born in Baghdad, and Ahmad was born in Cairo. And Joe, before the break, I had asked everyone else how we should measure the words of President Obama and whether or not there's any success. How are we going to measure it?
On the very best level, which President Obama was speaking, it's very hard to measure because he was speaking to that part of the Islamic world that is young. And the Islamic world is a very young world all across the globe. And the results
60% under
the age
35
of, and I think perhaps 50% under the age of 20.
Yeah, right.
So it's a very young part of the world. And so much of what may be accomplished by this and other things will be seen only later as people come of age and you see what civilizational changes, what cultural changes, political, economic changes take place, particularly among Muslim women around the world. But if we're looking at the more direct political consequences of what the president did, I would offer the following as conceivable benchmarks for determining whether or not he's had a positive impact. First of all, will we see a change in the way broadcasting takes place, where you sort of get one message in English language broadcasting and another message coming from particularly Arab broadcasters that comes in Arabic, where the latter, the rhetoric is harsh, it's often vicious, and it often continues to perpetrate stereotypes about Jews, about Americans, about the West, Holocaust denial and the like, which is soft-pedaled or avoided entirely in the English language texts and broadcasts. Another thing very concrete we can look at is will there be an embrace of the two-state solution in terms of Palestinian Arabs and Israelis by responsible Palestinian politicians and those in other Arab countries who support and assist them. Third, will we see electoral change? There's an election today, that is to say Sunday, June 7th, as we're live for part of this broadcast on tape, so it would be historical for other parts of it, going on in Lebanon, will we see a diminution in the popular support of extremist parties such as Hezbollah in Lebanon? There will be an election coming up soon in Iran. Will President Ahmadinejad be rejected by the voters in Iran? Will Pakistan's policymakers publicly say that they realize that the great strategic problem for the security of Pakistan, Pakistan's democracy, its parliamentary democracy, actually doesn't come from the Eastern Front? It is in India. It is the problem of the advancing Taliban and related extremists coming from the West, and change the direction of their military and intelligence focus away from India and to what is the real threat to them. Now, those are very concrete things. And last, let me say, will the Israeli electorate, not Israeli politicians, but will the Israeli people react in such a way not to have their fear heightened by the rhetorical changes with respect to the American stance toward Israel's safety and survival that are reflected in the president's speech in Cairo?
Thank you. We have mentioned a couple of times this evening, Gidi, I think you brought it up. You said that really the hot spot of the world is really Pakistan. That's what we should be focused on. That's where the worry is. It isn't Iran. It isn't even the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Putting that in context, based on the olive branch that the president extended to the Muslim world, if you were a Muslim and you were living in Pakistan, this is the same man who said during the race for president that if he had actionable intelligence, he would basically send in U.S. military and take out al-Qaeda, in basically invading, if you will, another country. And I'm wondering how those two messages coming from the same person, and yet in the best interest of the United States, maybe that's something we should do. But if we ever did that and acted in our own behalf, doesn't that fly in the face of the rhetoric in Cairo last week, Ahmad?
I don't think so, because I think he provided enough qualifiers. I don't agree with a statement like that, not in terms of rhetoric and not in terms of what it means. But I think the qualifier was, if we had actionable evidence to suggest that there was a preeminent strike from Al-Qaeda against the United States, which I think most people, rational people, would agree with. When he talked about
Afghanistan, rational people.
Right. But again, Okay. Remember, this speech was never addressed, and I don't think irrational people are going to be sitting there watching this type of thing.
I don't think the president's statement was actionable intelligence about an imminent strike. It was actionable intelligence that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were there inside Pakistan.
Well, the point is that if this were so easy and President Obama could do it, I think President Bush would have done it already. It's not so easy to be able to go and drop a bomb on al-Qaeda, and it's not really something that is limited to what Osama bin Laden wants to do. But it has to do with the large number of Pakistanis who have become radicalized in various towns, in within the military. And this is why I am worried about Pakistan. And some of the military, of course, will have control of the bomb. So,
when you're talking about those radical elements, though, and it's always been said that because the United States waged war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, primarily in Iraq, that has radicalized certain elements of the Muslim world. My question to this is: it seems to me that if you buy that, maybe some of the rhetoric of Barack Obama during the campaign and even after he's been president about what he's going to do if he finds evidence that al-Qaeda exists in Pakistan, this also is a radicalizing rhetoric. It's radicalizing as some of Bush's rhetoric.
Well, I think
you agree with
any
that?
Kind of problem that we have vis-a-vis Pakistan, we should do it diplomatically and behind the scene. We shouldn't be advertising it. We shouldn't go in and throw bombs on some of these Taliban-style Pakistanis within Pakistan, because
this is
only going to make things worse for us.
We've got to go to phone calls. Let's go to Mark listening to us in Chicago. We've had a great conversation, but again, we got lots of people chomping in the bed. Go ahead, Mark.
I have a couple points to make, and I'll try and be brief. Part of my problem that I have with this argument that, and I've been hearing for the last few minutes on how the extremist element of Islam is indeed so small relative to the 1.5 billion that exists in the world, that may very well be. But, in any given crazy world or in crazy society, small people always tend to lead the pack. And the realm either is ambivalent or they just sort of follow. And in this particular case, we, unlike in our country, where Americans in these days, it's in vogue to protest their leaders, whether it be Bush, who has never in the history of this country had to endure the amount of pressure, public pressure, both from the media and public protests like he did. But why aren't the Islamic people in this country standing up to these people who are tarnishing them, giving them a bad name? And I'll go a step further.
Let's let Ahmad respond to that question, then we'll go back to you.
Mark,
it's a direct question.
Mark, that's what I do for a living, and many of my colleagues share my profession. I encourage you to visit CAIR.com, CAIR.com. Every day we issue press releases. We engage in initiatives with Jews, Christians, others to speak truth to power about, you know, declaring our utter condemnation to the marginal radical elements within the Muslim majority world. But I disagree with you entirely when you say that they lead the Muslim majority world. They don't lead the pack by any means. They're very marginal. There's a reason why bin Laden is operating out of a cave somewhere in Afghanistan and not on a laptop somewhere from, you know, in the downtown Cairo Hilton. It's because he's marginal and underground and an outlaw within the Muslim majority world, just
but
as much as he has beyond.
He's had an incredible impact on history. You know, think back prior to 2001. The American people are fundamentally isolationist. We really are. We would rather stay at home and tend to our own vineyards and not be dragged into the problems of the Middle East. And after the end of the first Gulf War, we had drawn down our troops. We had drawn down our public diplomacy capacity. We'd collapsed the United States Information Agency. We had removed virtually all our active CIA and other intelligence assets throughout the region. There was one CIA active guy left in Afghanistan at the time of September 11th. And we'd gone home. The last thing on President Bush's agenda was getting involved in the Middle East. I mean, that was not something he'd campaigned on. He'd campaigned against nation building. It wasn't something on his agenda. And then September 11th happened. September 11th didn't happen because America invaded Afghanistan or invaded Iraq as a matter of choice or had done anything else of that
anyway,
kind.
Anyway, that happened later.
Of course, all of that happened later. September 11th happened because this tiny minority of Muslim extremists
19
and their directors and enablers and so forth. So, yeah, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands, but a relatively small number of them nonetheless managed to hijack in the world's consciousness Islam and acted in the name of Islam and created clearly they succeeded in achieving
Joe,
what they wanted
the
to
first
do
agree
a
with
clash
you.
Of civilization.
You know
there's no disagreement here whatsoever.
One second, Mark.
Don't misread my comments.
Stand by.
I mean, I say what I mean,
really
and I mean what I say. All
when
I'm saying is they don't represent the majority. But they're absolutely wrong.
Mark, hang on just a second. Mark, we've got too many. Folks, we got too many people talking at the same time. Mark, go.
Yes. I heard your response very clearly and how, again, once again, all the blame was seen to be put on Bush. But God darn it, I can't seem to hear the word Clinton. In the first attempt at the World Trade Center was done under Clinton. The two embassies in Africa that were bombed under Clinton. And last but not least, the cold. I mean, remember, this is before Bush won the election. He didn't even take office. Okay? The cold was bombed under Clinton. I'm going to tell you this. There's a man named Huntington. He's at Harvard University. Read his books. Bloody Borders.
That's the book whose title I use without attribution, right. Clash of Civilizations.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. We've got one more segment. 1-800-723-8289. Back shortly. From Rochester, New York to Charleston, South Carolina, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. We'll get back to calls and discussion in a moment, but I do want to ask Ahmad Rahaba, who is our guest this evening with the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. I mentioned that you've been a citizen of the United States since 1997. I'd like to go back to September 11th of 2001. You were a young man 8 years ago. What was your reaction when you heard the news? And did you instantly know that maybe your life was going to be affected in some significant way?
Not instantly. As an American, like anybody else, I was devastated. And when I found out that it was Muslims who committed this evil act, I was doubly devastated because first it was an attack against my country, but also it was an attack against my religion. It was a hijacking of Islam, as Joe put it. And as Imam Hamza Yusuf, a very popular American imam, put it. And so I knew that my work would be cut out for me. And it was at that point in time that I thought I would move from being a software engineer to being a civil rights activist that can defend my community against the backlash, but also speak truth to power against the radical elements in the Muslim community.
You went to in 2004, you were at a conference in Kenya. You said there was an epiphany, a social change in your life. What happened?
I had gone with the Council for a Parliament of World Religions to discuss refugee issues, and water reclamation, other things that were very important in Kenya. And at that point in time, just the sort of social exercises we went through gave me the feeling that I could do something along those lines for the Muslim community and for my country when I got back in terms of the relations between the two.
And also in your bio, it says you're a graduate of the FBI Citizenship Academy. What is that?
That's a program that the FBI puts together for community leaders and activists to introduce them to the work of the FBI in all of its breadth and depth. And I found that to be an eye-opener as well as to the type of work that these men and women do to protect the United States. Even if we have certain issues with some FBI policies, at the end of the day, it's a great organization working to protect our homeland.
A fear that we have heard articulated on this show from callers from time to time is that in the mosques of America, and there are many, as mm-hmm. Joe mentioned, certainly in every state, in the mosques of America, there may be anti-American rhetoric being articulated. Again, I'm sure you've heard that same charge. What can you tell us about the veracity of those charges?
Speculation and conjecture is easy to engage in. There has been no evidence by any organization or entity out there to suggest that within a mosque, within the walls of a mosque, there is any reason to believe there is more anti-American sentiment than there is at the local mall or in the park or in a college somewhere. There has been no evidence to suggest that.
And politically, the most significant
chance of death to America is
in American Muslim mosques.
In America is not evidence.
In American Muslim mosques, where
you've seen the videos of the visiting imams or the local imams with the translation appearing under the video of what they're saying. I mean,
I've never heard of that. Maybe
not in the United States.
Maybe outside of the U.S.
I've never heard of that. Even if there were such a thing, it would be extremely aberrational. I mean, you referenced the almost negligible Jewish extremists in Israel. And I think by that same logic and same token, you can understand that this is extremely aberrational. It does not fall into discussion of the general if you want to focus on the aberrational. But I'm not even aware of such an instance whatsoever.
In your view, are things better? Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? Or are they about the same?
Well, I'll be brief. I'm very much optimistic with the steps that President Obama has taken in terms of an honest dialogue of civilizations, not so much a clash of civilizations, as Samuel Huntington predicted, but rather the belief that we can move together. He said something very profound, and I'll close with that. He said that there is an easy way and there is the difficult path, or the right way. The easy way is for us to focus on our difficulties and obsess with them. The right path is for us to remember the golden rule, which exists in all three faiths. Do unto your brother as you would like done unto yourself.
Let's go to Boise, Idaho, where Marilyn is listening to us on KBOI. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Boy, you know, I called in with a couple of points, and I think I'm going to stick to them. The first one is the case of women in the Islam world. I think just very basically, if Michelle Obama would spend a little time talking, I think they would listen, and that would really be a good cause for her to take up. And the second thing is the press and Obama and Bush. And, you know, everybody talks about what he says, what he means, what, you know, all of these things, that his sentiment, that doesn't matter. You know, and then they picked on Bush, like Mark called in and said, you know, Mark and I represent a huge portion of American culture. And if these were Christians doing this, what these people in the Islamic world, I'm not saying that every person who's is Islamic is bad. You know, I interact with Islamic people every day in my community. And, you know, but nobody is speaking out about the truth of them. Look, in Ohio, we just know that this man who shot these soldiers, he came from a mosque that has three or four others that have been proven have come out of that mosque, and he went to Yemen. And these imams are not being held accountable because they hide behind religion in our country. That's what happens. If they shelter behind their own religion, they shelter behind the laws of other countries, and they shelter behind freedom of religion.
Marilyn, would you acknowledge that there have been many extremists in the history of the country that have hidden behind religion in this country?
Don't bring up Timothy McVeigh or some of these other people. You also said there.
I'm talking about the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, just as one. As one example, under the sheet of Christianity and Christian rhetoric, they engaged in terror against a portion of the United States.
Who?
The Ku Klux Klan.
Who?
Who did what?
Okay, but they're not out there in vast numbers all over the world doing this. I have relatives.
Well, they are. What we're talking about is whether or not there is a percentage. I'm not even going to say a small percentage. Is there a percentage of radical elements who have used religion to foster radical beliefs and violence? And the answer is yes.
Not to this extent.
And they have been Muslim, and they have been Christian.
And the latest example is Reverend Wright, who was just the president before he became Mr. Obama, dissociated himself from his views. He was attacking America. He was attacking whoever in his church.
We
don't have to go that far. Yeah. But I'd like to address the question of women.
You had 10 seconds to do it, because we're out of time.
Right. Okay. The problem that Muslim women in some countries face has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with the level of economic development.
Okay.
Poor women in India suffer, in Africa suffer, and they're not Muslim.
We got to come back. Listen, the panel was great. I hope you will all be. I'm going to invite you back in about a month or so to continue our discussion. Thank you all for joining us this evening. Joe Morris, Gidi Nashat, and Ahmad Rahat. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you for being with us tonight. Till next week, good night from Chicago.